Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, November 13th, 2011, and this is show number 338. Well, a while ago, Kyle traded laptops with me, choosing my 15-inch MacBook Pro over his 13-inch MacBook when I got my new one. Mostly he wanted it because of the improved graphics for driving games on a secondary display. This weekend he came home and he suggested we make a trip to the Apple store as he was having a couple of problems. He's noticed recently that when he first plugs in the laptop, it says it's not charging. Sometimes it does start charging after a little while, but other times it never starts charging. The other problem he had was that his Time Machine backup process was kind of getting dodgy. His machine would come to a crawl while it was running. Finally, his iPhone and mine both get stuck when syncing. The last step basically never finishes. Now, he only has that problem with syncing wirelessly. Mine has the problem wired and wireless. So we took a trip over to the friendly Apple store after getting an appointment with the genius. The woman we got was very efficient and clearly knew what she was doing, but she was really cold and impersonal and seemed uninterested in explaining anything to us. I made her, though. She ran a power diagnostic on the Mac and then on the power supply itself, and then peered very closely at every inch of the cable, after which she declared everything healthy. She did make some notes in the case, just in the event, you know, that things got worse later, that there would be a record of our visit. She told us we would be able to buy a new power supply if that were the problem, rather snottily pointing out that we are 27 days out of warranty. Next, she checked the hard drive and declared that it was failing. I asked her to explain why she felt this was true, since the only thing she had shown us was that Disk Utility had found some issues and said it had repaired them. She seemed very irritated that I would question her, but did show me two other hardware tests that both suggested it was failing. I asked whether we could get some leeway on the drive replacement since it was just 27 days out of warranty. She went off to check with the supervisor and came back and said no. You know, I thought about it as she was gone, and I realized it probably wasn't worth pushing it because it'd probably take days to get the repair done when we could pick up a drive over at Best Buy for under $100 and, have it replaced within that evening. We could do that ourselves pretty easily. So finally, Kyle asked her about the wireless syncing problem with his iPhone, and all she said was, "Yeah, mine gets stuck too." She just kind of stared at us blankly. No suggestions, no help, no checking to see that it's a known issue or anything like that. She just said, "Yeah, it got stuck." I asked her to elaborate on what we can do, and she said we'd have to make another appointment. I questioned that, and she said, "Well, it's one device per appointment." I suggested that the problem could be with iTunes, not the device, and she simply said no. Kyle didn't think she was as snotty as I did, but she sure rubbed me the wrong way. But this is actually a story of success, and it's the success of Time Machine. Now, over the years, I have really maligned Time Machine, told you how much it drives me crazy because it stops running for me. But the good news of the story is that Kyle is very good about backing his laptop up with a small external drive I bought him. So when we came home with his new 7200 RPM 500 gigabyte internal drive, Kyle was able to pop it into the laptop after removing just one screw, plug in the backup drive via USB, power up the machine. The Time Machine backup drive simply mounted and asked if he wanted to restore from backup. At first, it didn't see the new drive, but Disk Utility was available, so we simply formatted the drive as HFS Plus, quit Disk Utility, and Time Machine could then see the drive. A couple hours later, Kyle's machine was just the way he'd left it. Now, I've had no end of trouble myself with Time Machine, but I do still recommend it for everyone else because of these delightful success stories. I still have a dream that Time Machine will work for me one day. Well, it's time for an update on my progress using VoiceOver on the Mac and iOS in preparation for my Macworld pitch blindfolded in January. I continue to get more comfortable with the iPhone. In particular, my typing skills are improving at a fantastic rate. Originally, I was using a typing mode they have where you find the right key with one finger and you tap the screen with another finger to select it. It worked, but it was kind of clumsy. But I found out that you can toggle on a feature where you only have to lift your finger to select the key. That sped me up a lot. I do remember Dr. Robert Carter talking about that ages ago, and I was so happy when I found it. I can now actually address and send a text message most of the time. But I've been really stuck on OS X, pretty much baffled by it. There is so much to learn. But I spent a half hour on the phone with Bill Holton, who was tipped off about my crazy plan by Daryl Shandro of the Blind Access Journal. Bill was easy to learn from because he is just now transitioning from Windows to the Mac, so it's kind of like learning from the kid who's one semester ahead of you in the same class. He still remembers what's confusing. When you get too good at something, sometimes you forget what you didn't know. I think my favorite thing that Bill taught me was QuickNav. Tapping the right and left arrows at the same time turns this on, and suddenly you have access to some easier ways to do things. You have ways to find things with a single keystroke. I've had trouble wrapping my brain around the concept of interacting with an element, too. Let's say you're looking at a web page. There's a whole pile of text there in the center column. If you navigate to it, you can't actually do anything yet, like read it. It says HTML element. You have to choose to interact with it. Now, I think I mentioned last week the hand paralyzing gesture they taught in the Apple tutorial. That's Option Control Command Shift Right Arrow. Well, with QuickNav, you can just swipe to the right with two fingers on the trackpad. Bill cautioned me, though, that if other stuff doesn't seem to work right with VoiceOver, it might be because of QuickNav and that's messing it up. So you get good at turning it on and off. I then tortured Dan Eckmeyer for a while because I got really stuck on email. You know how mail.app has three columns, the list of mailboxes, then the list of messages within the selected mailbox, and then you got the preview pane? Well, I've been getting hopelessly stuck trying to move pane to pane. I'll be in the list of messages, but for the life of me, I can't get to the list of mailboxes. When you try to go the wrong way, it makes this bonk sound. It kind of reminds me of that noise that the game Spectre makes when you bonk into a wall. Really frustrating. Dan said he could help me turn that sound off, and I said, well, it's not the sound, really. It's the symptom of the sound that's actually the problem. So anyway, in talking with Dan, it finally came to me. That interact with element thingy is not a global toggle on and off. You can actually be buried levels deep into interacting. So you have to keep backing out until you're not interacting with anything at all, and then get to the next element. This was a huge breakthrough for me. I really think I can make some progress now. But then left to my own devices, I put up what they call the curtain. A triple tap of three fingers on the trackpad darkens the screen. So now I'm taking the training wheels off, right? I start trying to read my email, and I got confused really quickly. I pulled up the curtain to peek, and my inbox was empty. Now, for you inbox zero nutballs out there, that probably sounds fine. But I had 11,000 messages in there before I did this. The good news is that with a little hand-holding by Bart, I was able to find all the messages and put them back. But it was scary for a while there, and I'm not actually sure how I did it. Maybe I should try working with a less dangerous tool when I've got the curtain on next time. One last comment before we move on. When I was talking to Bill, I mentioned how nice it is that VoiceOver actually shows you on screen what's going on. And he muttered something about, you people and your photon dependency. Isn't that awesome? Photon dependency. I'm a photon dependent. Anyway, I can't tell you how much fun I'm having with this. I told Dan, I feel like it's like I decided to learn Klingon, and then I found this people who all know Klingon, and they're gently guiding me through to help me learn how to speak Klingon, too, because it really is like a foreign language.
Hi, Allison. This is Robert Lockman from Photography and the Mac.com. I just wanted to let your listeners know that I started a new podcast with the same name, the Photography and the Mac podcast. Do you think I should come up with a different name? Maybe something with a catchy phrase or something cute? Well, I think I'll just stick with something simple. It's going to be a weekly show where I talk about everything related to photography and Mac-related stuff. And, of course, that includes the iPhone and iPad. I'm going to mix in a little news, interviews, reviews, along the way with a few of my thoughts and rants. I'm going to keep it short. I've been taking photographs, it seems like, forever. I've worked at the LA Times as a staff photographer and editor for over 36 years. Wow, that hardly seems possible. I'm going to keep it fun with my simple approach to photography. I hope you'll check it out at the iTunes Store. The link will be on my Photography in the Mac website, and I'll send it along to Allison so she can post it on hers. I hope you'll give it a try and subscribe. Hey, it's free. I also want to thank Allison for helping me out with some great podcasting tips. I'll bet you didn't know it's not as easy as Allison makes it look. I think it's her great attitude and enthusiasm that really is the trick. Maybe I can learn a few things. Again, if you get a chance to check it out, it's the Photography and the Mac podcast. Thanks, Allison. I'll talk to you later.
Well, I'm glad you sent that in, Robert, because I am really loving this show. You won't get... This is not going to be a podcast like anything you've ever heard before. Robert has a very unique style of kind of throwing in all kinds of ideas together. And like he said, I love his focus on the simplest way to do things. You know, here he is, this crazy, amazing photographer for the LA Times. He's got lenses, you know, the size of your leg in his trunk of his car, but he does amazing things with his iPhone. So he's not one of those highfalutin, oh, you must have this $8,000 lens to be as good as me. You know, he just gets down to the practical side of things. And he's hilarious. So I am, I'm really enjoying the show so far. And it's funny, you say it looks easy because you evidently haven't come to the live show. Those guys know how many times I drop the balls around here. So glad you have started that out, and I'm glad you sent in the review. Well, this weekend, Steve and I went to visit his mom and dad because we needed to upgrade them to Snow Leopard. I know you're yelling at me that they should be going to Lion, but they really, really don't want to learn a new version of Excel right now. Yeah, they're on Office 2004, which only runs under Rosetta, which means they can't go to Lion and keep their old version. But at least I was able to get them up to Snow Leopard. So we did the upgrade, and both machines' upgrades went pretty well, until his dad tried to print, and it didn't work. Turns out his HP printer isn't supported past Leopard, but his dad was cool with that. He ran out and bought a new $60 printer fax copier, and he was delighted with that. He was able to get rid of his old fax machine, too. I felt kind of bad because I put out the call on Twitter of whether there was like a, you know, a cups driver or something like that for this that would give him the functionality. And Kirshen actually did find a way I could have done it. But by the time I read what she wrote, he was already back with the new printer. So $60, not too bad. I should also say that before I went to do the upgrade to Steve's mom's computer, I double checked that her Time Machine backup was running, which, of course, it was not running. Hadn't run since October or possibly March, depending on when you asked it. So I ran a couple of tests on it, started, you know, doing disk permissions check and that kind of stuff, and it was finding all these errors. And then I thought, you know what, I don't have this kind of time. I'm just going to delete the whole thing. I'm going to just, you know, reformat the drive and run a new backup. And it turns out she only had 30 gigabytes of total space used on her Mac. That's including her applications and all her photos, all of her, the operating system, every single thing she has was 30 gigabytes. So in about, 8 minutes, I had her on a new Time Machine backup. So anyway, I still wonder about that Time Machine stuff, why it stops, but she's backed up and doing good now. So when I got home this afternoon, there was a message from his dad saying that his printer icon was gone from his dock. I have no idea why he thinks he needs a printer icon in his dock, but mine is not to question why. I did a quick Google search, and I found out how to get it to show up. I could have called him on the phone and spent 45 minutes or so explaining to him how to do it, or I could pop up and clarify for Blue Mango Learning, take a few screenshots, pop up a PDF tutorial into an email, and I'm done. It literally took me less than 5 minutes to make that little tutorial, and a while later I got an email from Steve's dad telling me he was all good to go. If you don't think you have time to make tutorials, you might be mistaken. You might not have time not to do this. I save time, his dad says I'm his hero, and everybody's happy. You can get Clarify from the Mac App Store for only $30 for all your machines. Check it out at bluemangolearning.com/clarify.
Dumb questions.
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Hello, Allison. This is Professor Albert, and yes, I need your help again with a very, very dumb question. So dumb it makes me feel smart. Now, I'm always late. And my wife, Elsa, hates it so, so much. She's even telling all her friends that I am her late husband. So now, when I run into them, they scream because they think I'm a ghost. The reason I'm always late is I open scores of programs all at once on my Mac computer. Almost as many as you do, Allison Sheridan. but I don't feel comfortable sleeping my Mac with all the programs open, so it usually takes me 10 to 15 minutes to close down all my programs, so I am always late. Now, here's the dumb question, and it is dumb, Allison. It's very dumb. Is there a way to close all my programs at once so that I can finally be on time and come back to the land of the living? Help me out, Allison. You are so smart.
Oh, dear Professor, I hate to have you be late everywhere you go. I'm sure the people waiting for you must be devastated to be denied your presence. Well, the good news is that I found a couple of solutions to the problem. First of all, Apple actually built into OS X a utility to do this. In Apple support article HT1343, they explain that holding down Control Command Eject will quit all open applications. It's only one problem. It also restarts the computer. Now, in today's age of solid-state drives giving us quick reboots, that wouldn't be a problem. Except that with Lion, guess what happens? When it reboots, it reopens all the applications you had open before it restarted. All right, well, you might be interested in another built-in path. If you add the Option key to the sequence, so now it's Option Control Command Eject, it quits all open applications and shuts the computer entirely down. Again, when you boot up, your previously open applications will be reopened, but at least you'll make it to dinner at that time, and maybe you wanted those applications reopened. All right, I can hear it now. You want everything quit, but you don't want to shut down the computer, and you don't want to restart. Just about now, when I was writing about this, I started thinking, I had this vague feeling I had talked about this on the show before. The great thing about having a massive 5,000 per week word blog post is that virtually everything I've ever thought about technology is recorded, and searching over on podfeet.com will find it. Back on June 21st, 2009, in show number 210, Greg Norton opened the topic of how to quit all running applications at once. He found the freeware Quit Anything from Frozen Head Software. I got intrigued and I found Quit Apps from limit-point.com. Both of these are using the Unix command kill all, which is fun to say and even more fun to type. But wait, that's not all. The next week on show number 211, Jason Hyde wrote in saying that the fabulous app launcher Launchbar from obdev.at actually has quitting all applications built in as an action. Wow, that must be the final solution, right? Nope. David Hill gave us the exact instructions on how to do it using Automator. Then Sean Peterson did a Screen Steps tutorial showing how to do it in Automator and with Screen Steps. I put a link in the show note to Sean's tutorial on how to quit all running applications. So, Professor Albert, your question is not so dumb, and clearly is a question a lot of people have, and a lot of people have worked on to find the very best answer. You're going to have to find a new excuse to be late in the future.
Hi, Allison and fellow Nacilla Castaways. This is Rod Simmons from Simple Mobile Review. This week, I'd like to review a 3-in-1 camera lens kit for the iPhone 4. But first, let's start with a problem to solve. I laugh because we're all geeks. We really don't need a problem to solve to do this. We just love playing with technology. But I'm going to humor our host. So here's our problem. You have an iPhone, and really what you're trying to transition to doing is using that as your point-and-shoot camera. But there are all these little inadequacies of trying to use a phone as a point-and-shoot camera. For example, there's no zoom lens. There's no wide-angle options. You can't do macro stuff. You have no lenses that can really go on there. And then there's the whole connecting the thing to a tripod issue. So let me talk about the lens problem, and I'll mention the connecting to a tripod as well while we're going through this. So this week, I actually decided to order a 3-in-1 camera lens kit because I'm honestly an absolute dork when it comes to this stuff. But I grabbed the lens kit, and it comes with three lenses. A fisheye lens, which kind of gives you that circular look as the room is almost like in a bubble, like you're looking it through it like a through a droplet of water. Then it gives you a wide-angle lens, which I'm honestly astonished how well this thing works. And then it gives you a macro lens. So you're probably asking yourself, why in the heck did I need this and why did I buy it? I actually really did buy it to solve a real reason. I do a lot of product reviews, and often I need to take very close-up shots of the product, or I want to take, you know, wide-angle shots like I have, you know, like the phone, all the different connectors and the manuals and stuff, and I want to just put it on the ground and get a nice wide-angle shot of it. And I'm always running to get my SLR camera, and then I got to pop on this lens when I want to take these pictures. I got to pop on this lens when I want to take these pictures. And I said, you know, I'd really like to be able to just do this from my phone. Hence why I purchased these little lenses. what it allows me to do is utterly astonishing. So when I'm taking highly close-up macro shots where you want to zoom in on, let's say, the camera on a phone, or maybe you want to zoom in on like an iPad and you want to zoom in on like where the speaker little system is so you can show them how many speaker little holes there are and where it's located, or the dock connector or the USB connector or the rocker volume switch, I can actually use the macro lens and get my iPhone within inches of it. It will automatically focus in on it, and I can get pictures where everything behind my focal point is blown out and distorted, but the thing that I want in focus is crisply in focus. Now, the iPhone camera lens by default is not sensitive enough for me to be, you know, within like less than an inch away from something and to focus in on that, but a macro lens is designed for exactly that problem. The other problem I wanted to solve is that wide-angle shot where sometimes I'm putting a whole bunch of things on the ground. Now, the problem I usually ran into is because I lay the things out wide, what would happen when I took a picture with my camera is I had to do all this post-cropping of trying to cut out the tops and the bottoms to get that wide approach. Whereas when I just put a wide-angle lens on it, it works perfect. It crops it down a little bit top and bottom, so I can actually just take my iPhone, put it over the items I want, snap a picture, and it really does come out gorgeous. Now, I took this outside and said, let me give it a shot. Is it really wide angle? And surprisingly enough, it is. I put the wide angle lens on. I stood in the middle of my street and I took a picture. And so if you can imagine any average neighborhood in America, you stand on the street, you take a picture, you kind of get this shot of, you know, in front of you can see the sidewalks, but as you start getting close to you, the sidewalks slowly start to disappear because they're out of your peripheral view. That was natively with the iPhone. Immediately when I put the lens on and took the picture, it almost – the sidewalk just kind of pulls back towards me, and I'm able to see a significantly wider angle, so much so that I was – you know, there's a court that wasn't in the picture, and as soon as I put the angle lens on, not only did the court appear in the picture on one side, but also the other corner appeared. So at one time, the corner was fully lopped out of the picture, and then it magically just appeared just by putting on the wide-angle lens. I'm quite happy with this purchase. I don't see myself using the fisheye lens. I don't really get why people do that picture. There's probably a whole effect thing there that I don't get that Allison and Bart probably really fully understand. But for me, I bought it for the macro lens, or some people call them micro lenses, and I bought it for the wide-angle lens. Now, you're probably thinking, did he buy a zoom lens? I didn't, but there are some zoom lens options. Oddly enough, there's some zoom lenses you can actually get for your iPhone that will give you a 6x optical zoom. Now, you would never carry your iPhone around with this thing looking out. You look like an absolute dork. It almost looks like the length of an SLR lens, like the default SLR lens, and you can imagine that sticking out of the back of your iPhone. But it comes with a case that snaps onto the back of your iPhone. You bolt the lens on in there, and then you can take pictures. So, you know what? That reminds me. You're probably wondering, how do these lenses I purchased connect? Well, at first, I was a little alarmed. What it wanted you to do is take this little magnetic ring. It's magnetic on one side, and glue it to your iPhone or stick it to your iPhone via this adhesion. And that just... I can't do that to my iPhone. That's like sacrilegious. So the way I did is I actually bought a really cheap case, I think it was an Elgato case. I got a really cheap one for like $9.99, and then I stuck the ring onto that case. Now I can take the lenses. Actually, I super glued it on there. Now I can take the lenses and attach them to that case when I need them. So what I did is I just put the case and the lenses in a Ziploc bag, and I leave them in my bag. When I need them, I reach in the bag, grab the case, slap it on, put the lens on, take my pictures. When I don't need it anymore, take the lens off, take the case off, I'm done. That's exactly the same way the zoom lens worked. Now, I didn't buy the zoom lens, like I said, but it works the exact same way. So how much did I spend on these lenses? I spent $23.91 for this three-lens pack. You can buy it at Amazon. I think it was Prime eligible. It may not have been. I think actually I might have paid for shipping. Regardless, like I say, it was only $23.91. So it was a pretty cool steal and allows me not to have to grab my SLR for every single one of these. Now, I will start by apologizing because this was a long review. But let me add one more bit. If you're interested in being able to start using your iPhone more as a camera, because I said I want to start doing more video content for my site, and I'm going to leverage my iPhone as the source for that video, you can also get like a tripod. So if you have a tripod already, but you want to connect your phone to a tripod, consider looking at like a Glyph. It's pronounced Glyph. Adapter essentially allows you to connect your iPhone or a phone to a tripod using the Glyph adapter. I, of course, being the cheap person, I searched for the Glyph adapter and immediately realized that it was, I think it was $20 in price. But right below it, there was a mini adjustable tripod and camera holder for the iPhone that was $6.52. So I snagged that one up because it gave me the tripod. It also gave me the adapter that gives me the connection to go onto a tripod, and I spent $6.52. That better be arriving via UPS in a couple hours here today. I was trying to hold my review until then, but I figured with my weekend being looking as hectic as it is, I wouldn't get it done. I'm really sorry for such a long review, but hopefully you guys will try out the 3-in-1 camera lenses for your iPhone and tell me what you think. Take care, guys. See you next week.
Well, Rod, I got to tell you, I think I found a new item for my Christmas list. That sounds really, really fun. And there doesn't always have to be a problem to be solved. Sometimes the problem to be solved is that you just really, really want it. So the 3-in-1 camera lens sounds just like it. Today, I want to tell you about Text Expander from Smile. It is a good product that will make you more efficient. Many famous people say so too. They save time with it. And remember, time is money. All right, so there's a reason my ads don't sound like that. It's because I do not read something that the advertiser told me to say. I tell you about my experience, and I only advertise products that I actually use and like. I live on Text Expander. It's one of the very first things I install on a new computer, and it makes me really, really happy. If you get Text Expander, you'll be typing faster and wasting less time, both of which are great things in my book. Text Expander is only $34.95, and you'll find yourself telling strangers about it if you buy it too. Heck, there's a free trial, so there's like no risk to this. Why not give it a test drive? Check it out at smilesoftware.com, and be sure to tell them that Allison sent you. It's even in the Mac App Store too, so you can get it for all of your computers. Come on, go get it!
Last week, I was one click away from ordering a Blue Yeti USB microphone on Amazon when I remembered Allison's revived affiliate link on podfeet.com. But when I opened Podfeet, there was no Amazon link until I turned off Adblocker. After finding Allison's link, I bought the Blue Yeti for the same $80 deep discount I would have paid without a 3% cut to support the NoSilicast. Cost me nothing and helps Allison and Steve keep podcasting. If my oaky accent is any clearer, credit or blame my new microphone. Now, to find Allison's Amazon link, you'll have to visit her blog at podfeet.com. If you haven't been there before, take a look around. Allison puts an unusual amount of effort into podfeet.com. Most of the content you hear in her podcast is available in text on the blog. If you remember hearing a tip or review and want to find it, searching the blog is a lot faster than listening back through a bunch of podcasts. While you're there, click open number 336. Bart and I have been back and forth about the big news this week, Apple's delay of its requirement that applications sold on the Apple Mac Store be sandboxed. Bart thinks it's great. I'm cynical, remembering when Ma Bell conducted electronic sweeps of every phone line in America, seeking anyone who dared connect third-party equipment to AT&T's network. I also remember IBM frequently changing connections to its mainframes for no reason other than to block third-party disk packs. Times have changed. Business methods, sadly, have not. I'm putting some links to third-party opinions of Apple's sandboxing plans in the show notes. Take a look, and maybe you'll want to comment in the comments section on this week's show notes.
Well, thank you, George, so much for your lovely comments about the show and the show notes in particular. I'm really flattered that you like them so much, and it is a fair amount of work, so I do appreciate a little pat on my pumpkin head there. I also appreciate that you went to the effort to look for the affiliate link, even though Adblock was trying to keep it out. And that reminds me, I need to put back, I think I had it once before, I had a link that said turn off Adblock or something like that to let you know. Anyway, George's comments about sandboxing I played in particular right now because they were the subject of chit-chat across the pond. So we'll get to Security Light first, and then we'll hear more about what sandboxing actually means. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for chit-chat across the pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. What's shaking today, Bart?
What's shaking? The leaves off the trees? They're almost all gone, actually.
That reminds me, I was talking to a younger person the other day, and I said, how's Trix? And she goes, Trix? Who's Trix? I said, you know, it's a saying. It's like, how's Trix? And she goes, oh, is that like a saying from the 70s?
Well, in Ireland, that would have been common in the 80s. So I think we're always a decade behind.
I felt old. Well, anyway, let's go ahead and kick into the show. What do we got going in Security Light this week?
Security Light plus, I think. It's been a busy week, or a busy 2 weeks. Busiest we've seen in a while. First thing to mention, just sort of as a point of interest, given that it's something we've talked about a lot, is that there is more funny business with yet another certificate authority. This time it's a certificate authority in Malaysia. And they're sort of they're not a full CA. They're sort of a sub-CA. So the way it actually works is, so we trust
second
about...
Second tier?
Yeah, we trust about 300 certificate authorities. And they have the power to issue what are called intermediate certs. And anyone with an intermediate cert can issue their own certs. So for every one of those 300 CAs, there could be hundreds each of sub-CAs. So it's even worse than we described it in our simple view. So it's one of these sub-CAs that had the problem this time. So it's a certificate authority in Malaysia called DigiCert Malaysia, not to be mixed up with a US company called DigiCert. So we don't want to badmouth US people, this is the Malaysians. And they're a sub-CA of Entrust. So Entrust signed the intermediate cert that DigiCert Malaysia used to sign certs. And DigiCert Malaysia used that intermediate cert to sign 22 certs with a weak encryption key. Instead of using at least 1024 bits, or ideally 2048 bits of encryption, they used 512.
Why?
Which means that because they're idiots. there's no actual reason for doing something so silly other than, oops, I changed that switch and I shouldn't have.
Nice.
It's like, was there a default there that I wasn't supposed to use? Oopsie. I mean, it's just a mistake. It's not something you do for a reason. It's just a plain old mistake. The effect of that plain old mistake is that the actual cryptography of the certs is not secure. So an attacker could, conceivably using not impossible computing power, alter details inside the cert and make the signature appear valid. So they could take the cert which was issued for, you know, some random Malaysian site and make it be for google.com and make it appear valid.
Just because it wasn't encrypted as tough as it should have been.
Okay. Exactly. So that means that, in effect, these weak certificates could be morphed into a certificate for anything. So they're effectively as bad as stolen certificates.
Okay.
So the parent company have said that they are going to revoke the intermediate cert, and they're giving all of DigiCert Malaysia's customers a few days to get a new cert. And then every single cert signed by Digital Malaysia with the old intermediate cert will be gone.
Oh, okay.
So not just the 22, all of them. They're just taking the entire intermediate cert out of existence. In the meantime, the 22 actual bad certs have been given to the browser manufacturers, who can use those if they choose to add blacklists.
Okay.
So Firefox have done so. So Firefox 8 contains these 22 certs in the blacklist, as dot Firefox 3.6.24. And Microsoft have updated Windows, which means that Internet Explorer is also...
Let me guess, Apple's done squat.
Yeah. Now, these certs have all been revoked. So if Safari is actually using revocation lists as it should, then it should, in theory, all just work.
Okay.
But it's much safer if you actually blacklist the bad certs.
Right. So if Firefox, you know them, why not? Better.
Exactly. You know them, so you just add them to the blacklist. So that's done on Windows, and that's done in Firefox.
Okay. So there's nothing we need to do then?
We just update our browsers as we're asked.
Okay. I was glad to see Firefox come out with a new version again. That was nice.
It just cheers you up, doesn't it?
Oh, God. We're 27. No, we're 34.
Not quite, but not long, you know, this time next year.
At the rate they're going, they will be this time next year, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Anyway, so then into the regular bout of software updates. It's just a really big regular bout. So let's start with Apple. The first one is that iOS 5.0.1 is out, which, as well as containing fixes for the battery issue some people have been having, it also contains a number of security updates.
I did the update. Did it over Wi-Fi. It seemed to work fine. I'm fascinated by people who are reporting on whether it fixed the problem or not, because at least in my experience, the problem, the battery problem has been completely random. I'll have days. I mean, a couple days ago, I went to bed. My phone was at 53% when I went to bed. Other days, it's like by noon, it's at 17%. But it's like every 15th day, it goes bad, and then it's fine again.
Yeah, I think it's some sort of runaway process that when it runs away, it runs away.
Right. So anybody who's saying right now it works, I don't know. Yeah. Now, if they say it doesn't work, that might be true.
Yeah. You can prove the negative quite quickly.
Right. Right.
But so as well as doing that, which is good, and that will make a lot of people happy, it also contains some security updates for everyone, and in particular, some security updates for iPad 2 people.
Oh.
The funny bug where if you have a smart cover or any magnet that you can unlock someone's iPad 2 without their passcode is fixed.
Okay. That was goofy.
That was very goofy. It was just weird. It was just plain old weird. So that one's fixed, but there's a whole bunch of other ones fixed too.
Okay.
This is also the first update for over-the-air installation, which I did yesterday and found most pleasant. If you do it through iTunes, you still get the entire big massive download. But if you do it on the device itself by going into Preferences, General, Software Update, then you get a tiny little update that's like 34 megs or something like that.
48 or something. Yeah, very, it was very quick.
Yeah. And then what it seems to do, so it seems as if it has a copy of the actual installer inside itself, and it seems to just do a diff or something and merge those 34 megs into the bigger one. And then do the digital signature, because it takes ages to prepare the update, and then it seems to do a full install.
Actually, considering how long other updates have taken, I wouldn't use the word ages. I mean, there is a delay where you're going, what are you doing? But I mean, depending on my device, I was in and out in, you know, maybe like 7 or 8 minutes. Oddly enough, the iPad 1 took a lot longer. I started on the iPad 1, and I was sitting there watching it, and then I thought, oh, wait a minute, I could do my iPhone too. So I did the iPhone, and the iPhone finished probably 2 or 3 minutes ahead of the iPad, even though it started later.
Well, the iPhone 4 for me ran the same speed as the iPad, which, given the fact that they have the same processor, is not unsurprising.
Well, that's what I was comparing, Bart, an iPhone 4 to an iPad 1.
Okay, no, in my case, my 4 behaved just like...
That's odd. Okay, it's random.
So it works anyway, so that's the main thing. A little bit slower than you might think after you do a download. You might think, oh, it's finished downloading, we're done. But that's when it really kicks in. So, you know, be patient, it'll do its thing.
Relatively painless, though. I was pleased.
Yeah. Me too. Certainly compared to the usual thing of having to plug it in and all that kind of stuff. Actually, speaking of plugging it in, it won't do the update if it has less than 50% battery unless you're plugged in.
Yeah, it's funny. It told me to plug in the battery, and I was like, I'm at an 80%. Quit your whining. And I did anyway.
I did that on my iPhone, and it went, oh, okay. And then I tried it on my iPad, which was at 34%, and it went, no, sorry, you have less than 50%. You can't dismiss this.
Which is funny, since it only takes, you know, 5-10 minutes.
Exactly. I mean,
you really think it's going to drop that far?
I guess better safe than sorry.
Now, I'm kind of bummed it didn't appear to fix the problem a lot of people are having, and there doesn't appear to be a pattern for yet, where the iPhone gets stuck on updating something 6 of 6 or 7 of 7. It gets to the last step and gets stuck. I've been reading the message boards, and people say, oh, it's a bad photo in iPhoto. Oh, it's a bad video in video. Oh, no, it's a bad email that's causing it. They've got, you know, as many reasons. Yeah, they don't know. And, mine's stuck now. Mine was fine until a couple of days ago, and Kyle's started borking up 2 or 3 weeks ago. Mine is just started getting borked. I can't finish an update yet. I mean, a sync yet. Even though the update went through fine.
I won't say anything then about mine being okay for now, because if I say something, it'll go wrong.
Yes.
But that strikes me perhaps as being an iTunes issue, so we might see an iTunes update.
Yeah, it could be. The iPad's still fine, knocking on wood.
Okay.
All right.
So that's the first. That's the biggest one of Apple's patches. Then the next one they released was, or I'm not sure chronologically next, but the next one I have in my show notes is a patch for Java for Snow Leopard and Lion, so 10.6 and 10.7.
Good.
And then there's also a new airport firmware has been released, version 7.6, for time capsules and your airport base stations. So I did it on my Airport Extreme earlier today.
How would you know that if Bart hadn't told you?
I think Software Update will pop it up. In my case, I had internet problems, and so I logged into my router and I went, oh, by the way, there's an update. And I went, oh, okay.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. I'll check that out.
But my memory is that Software Update will pop them up, so you'll see if it happens or not in the next few days.
All right, sounds good.
Okay, then the next thing to say is that we already mentioned that Firefox 8 and Firefox 3.6.24 blacklisted those certs, but actually those updates do a lot more than that. They patch a whole bunch of arbitrary code execution, yada, yada, yada stuff.
Okay.
So you get those for more reasons than just the cert. Then Tuesday was Patch Tuesday. It was a fairly small list. I think it was just 5 updates, but enough to go around all the same. And the fact that it's small doesn't mean it's not important. One of them was still rated critical, which means you should absolutely positively do it. So wake up all of those VMs, etc., etc.
Right, right.
Now, unfortunately, there is another problem with Windows that was not patched in Patch Tuesday. And this one is kind of dangerous because it's being actively exploited and there are worms using it to propagate. And all you can do is a workaround at the moment, and I've provided a link in the show notes to one of those fix-it buttons that will disable the buggy feature until Microsoft can actually patch it.
Hmm.
So, and considering the fact that it is actually being exploited in the wild, I would strongly recommend that people do the workaround, because you don't want to be part of this thing that's going around. Yeah. I thought with Patch Tuesday they would have fixed it, but I checked and it's not listed as being fixed.
I wonder if
so, unless Microsoft's site is wrong. I hope they do. But obviously they haven't got a fix yet. We would have got it. So that's Microsoft. And then, of course, there's Adobe stuff.
Wow.
So today there was a fix released for Flash and Air. So expect those to pop up at you and scare you. And then there was also a fix released earlier in the week for Shockwave Player for Windows and Mac. And Shockwave is really, really, really old.
I was going to say, for the 8 people using Shockwave.
Yeah, it's basically, it's the precursor to Flash. I think Shockwave came from Macromedia when Adobe bought it.
Right, right.
So if you have it, first of all, consider uninstalling it, because you probably don't need it. But if you know that you do need it for some really obscure old thing, then update it. But I would say you probably don't have it installed. If you do, consider uninstalling it. It's old and dangerous, and it's probably time it died.
It's time that Flash died, for crying out loud. Well, it's almost dead.
I would agree with that.
We won't start that, though, because that's another hour discussion, isn't it?
It kind of is, but I do have to say, on the iPad, I don't miss it very often.
Oh, that's for sure. Well, and now with them abandoning the Flash for all mobile devices, I think you'll start to see Flash sites disappear.
Yeah, they kind of have to, because every tablet sold, every smartphone sold, is another nail in the coffin.
Oh, except don't forget, RIM is going to do Flash on its own.
Good luck with that, RIM, and watch your product suck even more.
It's so sad. All right, let's dig into our main topic, because this is a big, chewy one.
It's a doozy. If this were Security Now, I would be saying to get your beanie propellers out, or propeller beanies, or whatever you call those little hats with the propellers on them.
All right, I'm going to try to keep up.
Okay, well, the idea is to try not to lose people, so
okay.
So rein me in.
I'm allowed to say, huh?
Yes, please do.
All right.
So the first thing to say is what we're going to talk about is sandboxing, which is something that's topical at the moment because Apple have announced that by the 31st of March of 2012... every app in the App Store must be sandboxed or it will not be kicked out of the App Store.
Okay.
So people are talking about it because it's, that was a news item recently. A lot of misinformation doing the rounds. So everyone knows that iOS apps are sandboxed. And now people are hearing sandboxing for OS X and they're making the assumption that it's going to be identical to iOS apps. And that's not true.
So there's different types of sandboxing? Different levels? Different depths?
It's not even levels. It's different permissions. So a sandbox, you can look at it as being sort of a firewall for applications. And you can configure that firewall to let almost nothing out, or you can configure that firewall to let loads of stuff out. The technology is the same, but its implementation is, or no, its effect is very different because of the different policies applied.
Okay, so why don't we back up and start at the beginning? What is sandboxing?
Exactly. Well, yeah, that's what I was going to. So the first thing to say is this whole notion that iOS is going, that the Mac is going to be just like iOS. This is a classic case of the logical fallacy. Old dogs have four legs. My cat has four legs. Therefore, my cat is a dog.
Okay.
Which is a reference to a British comedy for people who get it. And if they don't, well, you need to watch more Yes Minister. Anyway, before we go into the technical, the what's, I want to talk about the what's and the why's and the sort of potential clouds on the horizon, maybe. So there are sort of the three phases I want to go through. But the first thing I want to do is I want to stop panic in its tracks before we get into this. You are probably utterly unaware of this fact, but on Lion, both Preview and Text Expander, or not Text Expander, Text Edit, are sandboxed. They have been sandboxed since the very first day you opened Lion. You have been using them just fine without any horrible side effects.
But I don't know what it is yet.
I know, but I'm just saying, people think sandboxing means the end of being able to open random files and stuff, right? Preview and Text Edit are sandboxed. No problem.
Okay.
So don't panic. It's all right. Okay, so now the what? I'm going to do a little bit of history because this idea is old. This idea is very old. So old, in fact, it goes back to 1979, which I think in computer terms is like dinosaur age.
It's like BC.
Yeah, very BC. So it goes back to a technology called CHROOT, or Shroot is what sysadmins call it, or Shroot jails. And this was a feature in early versions of the Berkeley Standard Distribution of Unix, or BSD. And, of course, this should immediately make Mac people go, wait a second, because OS X is based on FreeBSD.
Right.
So this is a technology that goes way back to the root of our Unix operating system that we use. So Shroot is of a similar form to other commands you may have heard of, like chown and chmod. So it's chroot, so change root. So we know that the file system on our Macs is a tree-like structure. And it starts at slash, and then you have slash home, and then slash home, slash your username, and so forth. So the file system starts at slash, and you can move around the tree, but you can never go beyond slash, because that's the bottom. That's the root of the tree.
Okay.
What chroot does is it changes the root of the tree for a process. So that process effectively gets islanded off in a branch of the tree. So if you have a folder called, say, slash home, slash Allison, and you have a process, say, called Allison's app, and you shroot Allison's app to slash home slash Allison, then as far as the app is concerned, slash home slash Allison is slash.
Okay, it's the absolute root. Okay.
Is the absolute root. It can see everything inside it, but it can never go up because it sees it as root.
Okay.
And so it's jailed in that folder, which is why it's called the shroot jail.
Okay.
So that is the earliest type of sandboxing, and that is a very absolute thing, but that's been used a lot. Almost every DNS server does this because the history of DNS has been troublesome. The DNS service has been very prone to being hacked, and so as a safety precaution, it's standard practice to run your DNS server inside a shrooted jail so that if someone hacks your DNS server, they can't get at any of your files because they're stuck off in a little island. This is something we do to this day. If you install DNS on a Linux server, the package you get is bind-shroot. So, you know.
Okay.
Now, OS X Lion takes this all to a whole new level. But it still does the shrooting thing. So if you go now in the Finder, and you go to the Go menu, and you hold down the Option key so that Library appears,
mm-hmm.
and you click on Library, and then you'll find the folder in your library called Containers.
Okay.
And in there are the shrooted jails for all of your sandboxed apps.
So I see com.apple.preview. That is root to the application preview then?
Yep.
Even though it's actually in... That's actually in... Which app library is this in for this way? Is this the root library?
Your user account.
Well,
this is in your user account.
So this is really slash Allison...
Well, slash home slash Allison slash
library slash container slash
container slash com.apple. So if you go in there and you go to com.apple to preview, inside that folder you'll find two things. You'll find the container.plist file that's going to be very important later, and you'll find the file called data. It's the file called data that actually gets truthed to. So if you open data, what you'll see is something that looks like a normal home directory on a Mac.
Right.
It has a desktop folder, a documents folder, a downloads folder, a library folder, a movies folder, a music folder, a pictures folder.
That's weird. Well, they're all aliases, though.
Not all of them.
Oh, some of them.
And the library isn't. So in other words, it gets out of the jail for anything that's an alias, because that just jumps it into the real file system, but it's stuck in the jail for anything that's not an alias.
So even though it's stuck in the jail, it can still go to the alias that's totally outside of that jail.
Yeah, because it doesn't know it's an alias. It's just following the file hierarchy. So the fact that that has taken it outside of its jail doesn't matter to it because it still sees it as being in its jailed file system. So depending on the permissions the app has, more or less of these will be links and more or less of these will be real files. So if you have a completely sandboxed app with zero access, not a single one of those will be an alias.
Oh.
And then the app is fully trapped.
Okay.
Okay, so that's that's the file system aspect of sandboxing.
Okay.
But there's more to it than that nowadays. So that's the old-fashioned truth, which has been around since the 1970s. But Apple are taking things one step, well, not one step, a few steps further. And they're not just blocking access to the disk, because that's just one aspect of your computer. They're also sort of filtering access to system resources. One of the most important ones they're filtering is access to the network. So that something in a sandbox can only use the ports that it's that the sandbox says it's allowed to use. It can't listen to a service. It can't listen on the network and become a server unless it has that permission. And it goes beyond the network to permission to interact with the system. So there's a permission, am I or am I not allowed to print? Am I or am I not allowed to access certain system resources? Am I allowed to access the mic? Am I allowed to access the webcam? All those kind of things.
Okay.
So it's become a list of rules for what the app can do. You can see those folders and those files. You can print or you can't print. You can use the network or you can't use the network. You can use the network, but only in this way. You can be a server, you can't be a server. You can use the mic, you can't use the mic. You can use the webcam, you can't use the webcam. So it's this whole massive list of permissions.
So who
gets to
decide what permissions an app gets? Does the developer get to make that decision or is someone else making that decision?
Yes. And we'll get to it in a moment. Because this is where container.plist comes into play.
Okay. So
we'll get there in literally the next thing. So a good way to think of a sandbox is as being like a firewall on your network. You specify the list of what's allowed, and everything that isn't specified as being allowed is denied. And so the idea is that you set up your rules for your sandbox to match exactly what the app needs and no more or no less.
Who's you in that sense? You as a developer
do it first.
Okay.
So the process starts by the developer writing the app and the developer writing the container.plist file, which will specify the needs of the app.
Okay.
And if you don't sell the app on the App Store, then that's where it ends. You have written the app. You have defined what the sandbox will be. You can just give it to people and they can run it and that'll be fine. If you sell the app in the App Store, then the app goes into Apple's review process. And the review process becomes much easier for Apple this way because they don't have to check to see whether you are as good as your word or not. They can just look at the container.plist file and it will tell them exactly what the app is going to be allowed to do. So you can say that this app doesn't use the network, and if you hide the code really well and make it only show up a month from now this code becomes active or something like that, it's very hard to verify that an app does what it says it does. But you can look at the container.plist file and simply read it off and you'll see what the app can do. So if you're writing a game and you submit it to the App Store and you say that you want access to system file permissions, you want access to startup items, you want access to all these things, and you're writing a game, then Apple are going to say, wait a minute now. You say this is a tic-tac-toe game. Why do you need access to the person's address book exactly?
Okay.
So,
but so if it's a game, easier. But if it's a an application that says in its description that it's going to do something with your address book, and you say in the plist it has to do with the, it's going to touch the address book, then that would be allowed?
Exactly.
Maybe.
So it's a way of tallying that what the app says it does and the permissions the operating system are going to give it are in line with each other.
Okay.
And the operating system is going to enforce those permissions. So even if there's malicious code in the app that tries to do more, if it's not in the container.plist file, then the operating system will just stop it and say, no, this is not on your list of allowed things. You are not allowed to do that.
Huh. Well, that sounds kind of good.
Exactly. So that takes us to the why. And that's one of the reasons of the why, is it because it makes it easier for Apple to do their app review process and to do it in a more accurate way. It actually makes it more reliable that their review is what is going to catch bad stuff, or at least stop bad stuff from harming our system. So it helps Apple in that way, but it actually does more than that, because we had it at the start of this segment in Security Light, this concept of arbitrary code execution. I mean, how often have we heard that phrase?
More often than I'd like to say.
Exactly. So what does that mean? What that means is that the bad guy, when they compromise the app, can make the app execute their code instead of the code that was written into the app.
Okay.
So you can look at that as turning the app into a zombie that is not doing what it's supposed to be doing, but is instead doing the bidding of the bad guy. So if you have a sandboxed app that gets zombified or compromised, mm-hmm. and it suddenly goes off and tries to do all sorts of things that it's not supposed to be able to do, well, the sandbox will stop it.
Well, why can't it just change the plist file?
Ah, okay, yes, I did skip something there. So it can't change the plist file because of code signing. So we talked in great detail about the concept of digital signatures preventing change. Mm-hmm. So a digital signature doesn't say this code is good. What it says is this code has not changed.
Okay.
So the container.plist is included in the digital signature from the app as it comes from the App Store.
Okay.
And the operating system verifies those permissions. So the instant the app starts, the first thing that happens is that the app's files are checked to match the signature, including the container.plist file. If it matches what was digitally signed, then the sandbox is started, created according to the container.plist specifications, and from that point on, the sandbox is set in stone until the process ends.
Hmm.
So you build the jail, and then you start the app inside the jail.
Okay.
And you verify that the jail is correct with the digital signature beforehand.
Before you start the app?
Before you start the app.
Okay.
So then the app is running, and then at some later time, let's say it gets compromised because you've opened the JPEG and there was a vulnerability in the JPEG library, and now the bad guy controls the preview process.
Okay.
But the process was started with the correct jail from the container.plist, which was verified to be correct. So that zombified preview app is stuck in prison. And what Apple have done that's unbelievably clever, right? Preview can open any file on your system.
Right?
But
can
the preview
or cannot?
Process can, but it actually can't. You think it can, but it actually can't.
Okay.
And the reason is because the file open dialog is not part of an app. It's part of the operating system.
Okay.
And if you look at preview, if you go into preview's container, you will see that your documents folder is not one that's an alias. It's one that's a real folder, which means that the preview process on its own cannot see any of your files. All of your files are safe from the preview process. And yet you can open all these files. And that's because by doing a human interaction of using the file open dialog, you are allowing the operating system to create a one-file-sized hole in the sandbox.
Okay, you have completely lost me. Back up. Okay. Hang on. Let me tell you where I lost you, because I lost you quite a few turns back. So com.apple.preview has this data folder, and in it, it has folders and aliases to folders.
Mm-hmm.
The preview one has documents not as an alias, so that means that preview can see everything in your documents folder.
No, it means it can't. Aliases are holes out of the sandbox. So
non-alias are
stuck.
Fake.
So it has its own copy of the documents folder.
That's also very weird, because I don't keep my documents in documents. It's not where they live.
Okay, but it would be the same on anywhere else in your file. So it will also work for stuff not in your documents folder. But what actually happens when you do file open, the file open dialog is not a part of preview. It's a part of OS X.
Okay.
And by doing file open, you're actually making an alias to the file that you've said file open and putting that alias into the sandbox.
No, but it's not an alias. Documents is a non-alias.
But the file will be. The moment you open a file, an alias to that file will be put into the sandbox, perhaps inside the document.
Okay, so I open blah, 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 dot PDF. It puts an alias in this sandbox documents folder.
Yes.
Got you.
Or the sandbox to whatever folder.
Okay.
So the only file that the preview process has access to, if it were to be hacked, is the files that you have explicitly opened at that minute in time.
Okay.
So it can't go scanning around your hard drive. It can only see what you've opened with it.
But can't it do everything I can do?
Well, no, because it's in the sandbox and you're not.
Wait, but I'm pushing the file open box, so I can say file open anything I want.
Yes, but that's you, the person, is interacting. So
I see what you're saying.
If the process has taken over, the process can't do things behind your back. It has to be a manual process. You, the human, have to do this.
The
human, can do it in two ways. You can go file open, or you can drag and drop onto the app.
Where you're going here.
Exactly. So what that means is that the only things that get leaked in are things that you choose to let in. And nothing that you don't choose to let in is accessible. So it doesn't affect you in your day-to-day life because you're opening and closing files willy-nilly and it doesn't matter. It just works like it always has.
Okay.
But behind the scenes, you have this massive protection from the sandbox. And it's done in such a way that it doesn't affect you.
Hmm.
So you have all the security and no inconvenience.
So, okay, this is not at all what I would have expected it to be. I can see how people are maybe misunderstanding what sandboxing even is. One of the questions I was going to ask you, and tell me if I'm asking at the wrong time, one of my fears, without knowing what the technology did at all, was that certain apps that do interesting things would now not be allowed in the Mac App Store, and maybe they aren't already, but something like Text Expander, where on iOS it's not allowed to touch all the different things. And my understanding was because it was it can only be allowed to use the apps that allow it, and the OS doesn't allow it. So you can't use Text Expander all across all apps on the iPhone. But on the Mac, you can. And I was thinking that the sandboxing thing would maybe stop that from happening on OS X.
It shouldn't, because what Text Expander does is it doesn't actually interact with those apps. What it actually interacts with is OS X's accessibility features.
Oh, that's right, because you have to turn it on, yeah.
Yeah. So what Text Expander would do is they would apply for permission to access accessibility in their container.plist file. And given the fact that they're in the App Store already, I don't see why Apple would suddenly decide that they don't trust Text Expander when they did trust them today.
So
then they would simply add that permission into their list of things they request access to, and then they would get that permission and go ahead.
Okay.
Where it falls, the only apps that would have issue would be apps that wouldn't be allowed in anyway. Like, anything that needs your admin password is not allowed into the Mac App Store. And that's true now, this instant. So sandboxing, they won't allow people to get the permission to become root, which in theory you could have inside a sandbox.
Okay, so...
But they don't allow that in the store anyway.
So that would explain the problem that Reggie Ashworth has gone into with app delete, because I think you probably have to have privileges in order to delete something?
Yes.
So but this doesn't change that. This is a technology policy to keep something from working as opposed to a policy on Apple's behalf.
Yeah, so Reggie has run into a policy issue. And sandbox... He could set up a sandbox in such a way that he would be able to do what he has to be able to do.
Oh.
But Apple would not approve that container.plist because it's against their policy.
Okay, two totally separate things. Is that where the confusion on the interwebs is, of people panicking?
I think so. I think so, to be honest. So the policy isn't changing. The policy is what the policy is, and the policy will continue to be whatever Apple decided to be.
Right.
The technology allows more than the policy. So sandboxes can do more than Apple are letting people do in the App Store at all. So the sandboxes aren't really going to cause the kind of trouble. The issue will just be that they will not allow certain things into the App Store. So you can write your container.plist file to give you access to everything you want. You'll submit it to the App Store and Apple will go, I'm sorry, that breaches our policy.
And that's no different today than it was yesterday.
Exactly.
okay.
So if you're the curious type, and I am, let's face it, if you want to get more of an idea of what's going on, container.plist is a plist file.
I tried to read it just now, and it was full of glop.
How did you attempt to read it?
I tried to open it with phrase.
No, you need to open it with Xcode.
Oh, I don't know how to do that.
Do you have Xcode installed?
No.
Oh, that'll be why then. You can get Xcode from the App Store for free.
I need to do that anyway for another reason. I'll tell you about that later.
Okay. If you have Xcode, you just double-click it and it'll open in Xcode.
Okay.
And what you will see in there is you will see the permissions that it asks for. So I stuck some examples into the show notes of some of the things that you can ask for. So the first one I took is some examples from TextEdit. So it asks for com.apple.security.document.userselected.readwrite equals yes. In other words, this sandboxed app can read and write to any document that the user has chosen, either file open or drag and drop. So they have been given that permission, which is why TextEdit can edit your documents. And then com.apple.security.print equals yes means TextEdit can print, which it can.
Okay.
If you look a little further, I also have 1Password installed, and 1Password is also sandboxed already. And in 1Password's one, you find a different permission that is not in TextEdit, which is com.apple.security.network.server equals yes, which means that 1Password is allowed to start a server process, while TextEdit is not.
Hmm.
TextEdit, of course, has no need for such a thing, whereas 1Password does.
Okay.
So if you're curious about the different permissions that apps have, if you just read their container.plist files, you can read off all the permissions they're given. It's kind of cool.
As long as you're smart enough to download Xcode first.
Yes. But you do need to be a tad nerdy to go play around with with these kind of things. But, I mean, it's not going to be of interest to non-nerds, is it?
Probably not. But as soon as you said I need to download Xcode, I went right over going, I got to get that. Why don't I have that yet? I must need that.
I take it you're downloading it now?
Yeah, is that a problem? Is there bandwidth gone to crap?
Your voice is
going to
be crunchy on the Skype call, but that's fine because you're recording on your end.
I think with 25 megabits down, you wouldn't have noticed it, but sorry about that.
Yeah, it's fine. I can still understand you. So really, this is a security technology, and the policies Apple put around it are no different to the policies Apple put around the App Store anyway. So any restrictions that end up in place on apps is not because they're sandboxed. It's because Apple have a policy in place.
And they can have the right to be as snotty as they want.
Exactly. So where this fits into the picture is it's one of three other technologies that are helping make the Mac a very secure operating system. So the first of those is something called Data Execution Protection, or DEP, and that makes it harder to get arbitrary code execution, but not impossible, but definitely harder. Then another technology that we now have is something called ASLR, which is Address Space Layout Randomization, which is a mouthful. And that makes it harder to do anything with your random code when you manage to get random code despite DEP.
Mm-hmm.
And then another piece of the jigsaw is digital signatures, which means that an app sitting on your hard disk can't be modified, and then when you run it, you hack yourself. If they're going to do something to take over an app, it has to be while the app is running. And then the fourth piece of the puzzle is sandboxes, which means that if you manage to get arbitrary code execution despite DEP, and you manage to do something useful with it despite ASLR, and you have, you know, the digital signature means that you can't write stuff to the disk to run next time, then when you do manage to get to do your arbitrary code, it can only do what the sandbox allows it to do. So it's a belt and suspender security process. It's called defense in depth. So we have all these layers of security protecting us, protecting us, protecting us. And every layer is a big obstacle for the bad guys to have to overcome. And any one layer can be overcome with a bit of work. But I mean, you've got to get over all those layers. The amount of work is much, much higher.
So it's sort of like, yeah, you can put an alarm on your house and a lock and a deadbolt. But if the guy's going to come with a tank that's going to ram it, you know, they might get through anyway.
Yeah, so what you then, if you want to protect against a tank, you need another layer of security, which is some sort of moat.
So this is just building all of those layers, right?
Yeah, the way you should think of it is, just a lock is not great. Just an alarm is not great. Just a deadbolt is not great. But a lock and an alarm and a deadbolt, that's much more useful.
Right.
That's defense and depth.
Okay.
And this is just another important bit of depth. I mean, if you look at things historically, people have always said, oh, the Mac is not being hacked because there's so few Macs out there. But when you apply that to the iPhone, it doesn't hold up. The iPhone is one of the, if not the most popular, one of the most popular smartphones out there. And iOS also runs on iPads and iPod Touches. So in terms of mobile operating system share, the Mac has a huge share. It's not insignificant. It's not 5%. It's, you know, depending on who you ask, it's over half or about half or a little under half, but it's really significant. And yet, iOS is not suffering from the Windows level of attack. And the reason for that is that the iPhone has DEP, ASLR, digital signatures, and sandboxes. It has those four layers already, and now Apple want to take that same security back to the Mac.
Now, my friends on the Simple Mobile Review podcast would think I was remiss if I didn't say, yeah, but didn't the iPhone just get hacked this week?
Did it?
The Charlie Miller attack?
Yeah, okay, but that's a case of Apple have to patch something. All software is imperfect. So DEP is imperfect, which is why it's not a perfect solution. ASLR is imperfect, which is why it's not a perfect solution. And where Charlie Miller found the problem was in digital signatures.
Okay.
So what he found is a way to attack one of the four layers of defense.
And by getting through one of them, he got through all of them?
Well, he would have had to work hard. Basically, an actual exploit that would actually work has to get through all the layers.
Okay, so
he would have had to find hacks for them all, but Apple are constantly patching these things.
But he did find hacks. He did find his way through.
Yeah, but he won't find his way through for long.
Okay.
I mean, but that's the case. I mean, Windows 7 and OS 10, you know, Windows 7 has everything apart from the sandboxing. Well, it has sandboxing, but it's not being made compulsory. It has DEP and ASLR too. So these things all make it harder. So I didn't say that the iPhone is unhackable. I said that it was very hard to hack.
Okay.
And that statement still stands. It is a big mountain to climb. People have climbed Everest. It was not easy, and not many of them will.
So are the other mobile operating systems more attacked than? I mean, I don't hear about Android exploits, but maybe I'm just not listening.
Oh, there's all sorts of Android viruses out there because all you have to do is just put them in the App Store. There's no protection.
Okay, because there's no sandboxing.
There's no sandboxing.
Okay.
I don't know about DEP and ASLR, but there is no sandboxing and digital signatures are not required.
And no policies.
And no policies.
Okay.
So it's a Wild West type of place. Which, you know, the only potential downside to this is the question is, how will Apple manage the policies of the Mac App Store? That's the only way in which sandboxing could become a problem is if Apple have a policy to only allow very restrictive sandboxes.
Okay.
But it'll always come back to a policy.
Okay, and that has nothing to do with sandboxing, again.
Exactly. The technology can allow anything.
Okay.
But it's the policies Apple choose to put in place is where the stumbling block will be. And if OS X ever becomes a fully closed system with no sideloading of apps and everything having to go to the App Store, a la the iPhone, it will be entirely because of policy, not because of technology.
Okay. This might make it easier for them to know what you're doing in order to make a policy decision, but it doesn't change the fact that it's the policy that does it.
Exactly. It will always be the policy, because the technology can allow anything.
I hate to admit this, but my propeller beanie's fitting pretty good right now. I think I got it.
Hey, great. That's good to know. I guess just to sort of round off and give a little more context, what this is something we call an ACL-based system or access control list. And this kind of access control list idea where you have permissions to do X and permissions to do Y is at the root of something called SE Linux or Security Enhanced Linux. And so it's not an idea that's new in any way. So just like the truth of jails are old, SE Linux, it's not quite as old as truth or jails, but it's been around for a while. So Linux servers tend to do this kind of thing already, and it doesn't stop Linux servers doing anything. So this is not new technology. It's just Apple are implementing it. They're doing it slightly their own way, of course, this idea of having containers in your library is not how it's done on Linux, but that doesn't matter. The actual ideas are the same. So you have access control list-based control. So it's basically a firewall for apps that firewalls their access to the internet, their access to the hard disk, and their access to the system.
All right. Well, cool. Does that pretty much cover everything?
That covers all of my show notes.
All right. Well, that was pretty impressive that you could break that down for me. Like, I don't give my propeller beanie as much credit as your ability to teach. So I don't always keep up, but I think I got it this time.
Phew. Good.
Now we'll see whether George from Tulsa has any more comments from this, right?
We should say there's been a long discussion on the chat room of the 2 week ago show. But I mean, George is afraid that Apple's vision is that the Mac will be like iOS. And if that's true, it will happen with or without sandboxes.
Right. I think we got it now. All right, Bart. Well, this has been a lot of fun, and we'll talk to you soon.
2 weeks, I think.
I think so.
All going to plan.
Sounds good.
Okay. Until then, happy computing.
Wait. Breaking news. Bart contacted me late this afternoon after we'd recorded. It turns out that iOS 5.0.1 solves the problem that the Charlie Miller hack exploited. So have no fear. It's all fixed already. But that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills. We've got Screen Steps and Clarify over at BlueMangoLearning.com and Smile from SmileSoftware.com. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at Allison@Podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter @Podfeet. I am also on Google Plus a lot lately, or as Nurse Ratched would say, I'm on the goop. And so just search for me by name if you want to circle me up. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, and I'm telling you, it is a party in there tonight, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic No Silicastaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.